there is this tendency to become overwhelmed and to feel helpless and to feel like it wouldn't even make a difference if I tried. And so instead of trying to do something, we don't do anything.
Welcome to the ATSI podcast. I'm your host, Justin McRoberts. I met Sarah DeBarge in Houston, Texas, a number of years ago at a gathering of artists and writers and speakers who were interested in advocating on behalf of kids living in poverty. And I was immediately struck, not just by how articulate she was and how thoughtful she was as a person, but by the depth and the breadth of her understanding of human flourishing. That depth and breadth of what it looks like for a human to be fully alive runs its way through all of the work I see her do. Her Instagram feed, both of her tremendous and wonderful books, and any and every single time I've had the opportunity to sit down and have a conversation with her, including this one, I think you'll see the same. Check it out. You're in San Francisco, because that's where you live now.
Yeah.
But you're not from San Francisco.
No. I grew up very far away from San Francisco in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which is Amish country.
Yep.
So I did not grow up Amish, but it was very, very conservative Baptist. My dad's a Baptist minister and grew up conservative Baptist to the extent of like, you're not supposed to cut your hair because long hair is a woman's glory. Okay. And couldn't wear makeup, and I had to wear dresses well past the knee, if not to the ankle, one of the house. And then there's this summertime phenomenon known as culottes, which are these super baggy, not even shorts, but kind of. So yeah, I had a lot of culottes.
I like, and yeah, so just as a title, I mean, if someday, like if it was just like a singular blog, if not a blog series, maybe a book, could be the memoir, I didn't grow up Amish, comma, but, dot, dot, dot. Like, just,
that's just. Let me put it this way. Okay, so what happened was I grew up that way, right? And then I decided that I really wanted to get a college education. No woman in my family had ever gone to college before.
Are you serious?
And I just decided that the life that every other female relative I had pursued, which was getting married before age 20 and having children and being a stay-at-home mom, which of course there's nothing wrong with that, but I just knew it didn't fit me. And I really wanted to get an education. And so I got a college scholarship at a small Christian college in Los Angeles. So I got on the plane. I went to the master's college. So this is a whole other thing. So John MacArthur is the president of the master's college. So he's very much along the same vein as John Piper, like uber conservative evangelical Christian. And it's fundamentalist Christian, really. But if it tells you anything about how I grew up, going to the master's college to me felt like a liberating experience because I could wear pants to class on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Oh. And shocking, I know.
Right.
And women wore makeup and some of them had short hair and you could go to movie theaters and you could listen to the radio. You could listen to pop music on the radio. And that to me, everything about that was brand new and felt like a liberating experience. It wasn't until a long time later that I realized how fundamentalist it was, but I didn't see it because compared to my upbringing, it was really expansive, I guess. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there really is something to be said for, I don't even, you would call it an incremental change, but like the small steps, like there's just not a chance in the world I could be wrong, but like, you're not going to bounce from there to USC and feel like you're making progress. You might like land at USC instead of the master's and last like a week and then bounce home because you weren't ready for whatever that was.
Yeah. Or go off the rails. Yeah. Right. I mean, there's a kind of a trope specifically about pastors' kids, that you're an angel or a demon. And I think there is this idea of, like, if you have had rules on you your whole life and then the rules aren't there, you don't have any kind of internal way of making judgments about, like, this is good for me, this is not good for me, this is healthy, this is not healthy, this is wise, this is unwise. And when that's the external rules are gone, don't have the internal built in, you go nuts. Like, you go off the deep end. So I think that was, you know, that's always a potential as well.
Yeah.
You can cower when you get exposed to things that are unfamiliar, or you can indulge and make some things that you probably will regret.
Well, and yeah, and, you know, regardless of how, you know, what direction you're wanting to move, there is something to be said, because you can, from where you are now, from where we are now, look back 10, 15 years plus and be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe. But at the time, that's the step maybe you needed. Like, you needed the small step. You needed the, like, which leads all the way down to, like, you know, you and I both have plenty of friends who are way further down the line in this issue, way further down the line on that issue. And it's really easy to turn back around and look at folks who aren't where you are yet and be like, oh, Why haven't you caught up with this yet? And I'm like, bro, you were there too.
Yes.
And it took that for you as well. Like, if you're gonna be a progressive, be about progress. Yeah. Otherwise you become a fundamentalist and either everyone lives up to your standards or they're out, which is, like, always the problem.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, so
it's just in politics. Right? Like, you can accuse the other side, but if you pull just as hard and are just as rigid and judgmental in the opposite direction, it's the same thing, just opposite sides of the tug of war.
Yeah. And you can be as right as you want to be, but if you're not taking people with you, I don't know how much it matters. Three days removed from an oncology checkup, which you wrote about publicly. And what I want to do for the first bit here is, your medical health is you have a significant story with health, like, ongoing for several years, many years. It's part of your personal story, and you've shared it publicly. It's become a significant part of your public storytelling. What I'd love to do is get into this. And so there'll be some listeners who won't be as familiar, that haven't read well, as they have like picked up on your stuff in the past. So I want to have you give a little bit of your history so that folks kind of get a gauge on where you're coming from. But ultimately, once we get through that, I want you to talk about, like, the choice to and the experience of talking about health publicly. Before we get there, just to set the table, like, it's, you know, it's not just like you've had a rough couple years. This has been a long stretch. You've seen some stuff. Can you set the table for listeners right now? Like, why is health, physical health, mental health as well, but why is health a thing for you? Why do you talk about this publicly? Why is the book called Well? Personally, this comes from your life. What happened?
Right. Well, to set it up, I was really passionate about pursuing a career in medicine because I wanted to help heal other people. And so I got a master's degree from Yale, and I'm a PA, I'm a physician assistant. And then I was getting a master's degree from Columbia in journalism. And I thought I was going to be some kind of high profile health reporter and maybe practice the medicine internationally. And that was my goal. Mm. And the fact that I got into two Ivy League universities back to back, I was just, like, on a roll. And I thought, this is what must happen if you love God and God loves you and you try hard and you don't screw up too majorly.
Right.
Like doors fly open and things go great. And so I was kind of riding that wave when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I was 27 years old, which is almost less than 1,000 women under age 30 are diagnosed with breast cancer every year in the U.S. It's so random and rare.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a family history. I didn't have any risk factors. I had no idea. And I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and it was just on the right side, but they said, since you're so young, the chance of it coming back on the left side in your lifetime is high, so you should just have a bilateral mastectomy. Hmm. And so I did. So 27 years old, I had a bilateral mastectomy. And then I went to see my oncologist a few weeks after the surgery, and I asked her, what are the chances that this will ever come back in my lifetime? What are my chances that even though I've had a mastectomy, the cancer will come back? She said, the risks are so low, they are incalculable. It's as close to zero as you can get without being zero. And I thought, that's wonderful, because I have a life to get back to. I have a plan. And I've been dating a guy right before I got diagnosed. This guy that I've been dating for 3 years, he flew me to LA. We went to Tiffany's on Rodeo Drive. Oh. He picked out the engagement ring.
Oh, that
he
guy.
Called my dad and asked if he could marry me.
Oh, wait.
And so,
he's like that. He was that guy. People tell stories about that guy. That's where he was.
Book. So I wrote about the cancer part in my first book called The Invisible Girls, and I had to change his name because I had so many people wanting to track him down, because in a minute you'll find out why they wanted to track him down, but I had to change his name because we were ready to get married, and then I got cancer and had a mastectomy. He stuck with me through that and after that, and then a year later I was going through reconstruction. So at the time of the mastectomy, they put in an expander, which is like a temporary implant that they add saline to every couple of weeks to expand your chest wall. So a year later, I had the exchange surgery where they take out the expanders, put in permanent saline implants, and then the reconstruction is done. And a few days after that surgery, I got a phone call, and my oncologist, who I hadn't seen in almost a year, was on the other end. And she said, did anybody tell you that when they did the surgery, they found something?
Whoa.
And I said, no. She said, well, when the plastic surgeon went in to do the surgery, he found a suspicious mass in the muscle on your chest wall, and they sent it off for a biopsy, and the pathology just came back today, and it's cancer, only this time it had morphed into the most invasive, aggressive kind of breast cancer that you could get. So the cancer that had as close to zero as possible chance of ever coming back came back a year later with a vengeance.
Wow.
So at that point, I had 4 more surgeries to get it carved out. They couldn't, they kept being able to not get it all, not be able to get clean margins.
Yeah, not 4 then because you scheduled 4 because you would go in and then you had
Yeah,
to
every
back.
Time I would go in, we think we got it, and then the pathology would come back and the margins weren't clear, and they're like, well, we got to go back again and again and again. And then I had chemotherapy, and the cancer grew back while I was on chemo. I had this little lump on my chest, and it started getting bigger and bigger like every day. And so I went in to see my surgeon, and I said, this doesn't seem normal. She said, it has to be scar tissue. It's not possible that the cancer's back while you're on chemo and that it's growing that fast. And I said, just to make me feel better, can we just biopsy it? So we did, and sure enough, it was more cancer. It was growing back. You could see it growing every day. So at that point, I was like, well, the chemo's not working. So we stopped the chemo and went through more surgeries and then radiation just to kind of zap it before it could spread. And then went back on chemo. And then 2 days after my last chemo treatment, I ended up in the ER because I couldn't breathe and my heart rate was over 200.
Man.
And it turns out I was in sepsis. I had pneumonia, and the infection took over my body so fast that my organs were starting to shut down. So I got admitted to the ICU with less than a 50-50 chance of ever making it out of the hospital alive. And I was all by myself. I was in Connecticut. because I had finished at Yale. I was doing grad school at Columbia. And then the guy that I was going to get married to, just a few weeks before I ended up having sepsis when I was in the middle of the last round of chemo, he broke up with me. So he was gone. My family was far away. And so I was by myself in the ER thinking I was dying.
Man. And that's why people wanted to track him down.
Yeah, he took me to Starbucks. He told me that we were going on a date. He drove me to Starbucks.
He did.
And we sat in the car in the parking lot of Starbucks.
No.
And he turned to me. Yeah, he turned to me and he said, "Babe, I can't do this anymore. It's just too hard."
Oh my gosh.
Just broke my heart. And then he said, "I'm going to get a caramel macchiato. Do you want anything?" So he got himself a coffee and then drove me home, dropped me off at my apartment. And as I'm standing there just on the sidewalk sobbing, watching him drive away, I realized that the whole time he was breaking up with me, he hadn't even bothered to put the car in park.
Oh, wow. He was like ready to... Did you get anything? Did you get anything from Starbucks?
No. No.
No, you didn't. Which then, I mean, this is not... You didn't have just a general... I mean, you went in with an academic... clinical interest in health, physical health. And yeah. Then you entered into this world, this cycle where it's the connection between your physical health, your mental health, your emotional health, your spiritual health, relational health became this whole thing, this big soup, because there you are standing without coffee and like everything about what you would name, anyway, like any descriptor of a healthy life, the thing you were planning on, hoping for, in tatters for the most part.
Yeah.
And so you're not writing from a standpoint of like, hey, these things are interesting. This is like legitimately, this has been my life.
Yes.
Talk about the decision to make that story public, because it's not just a matter of you being able to be articulate. There's a real specific decision for you, like a conscious decision to put this out, to talk about not just, you know, a breakup, but that kind of breakup, to talk about cancer, to talk about surgery, to talk about, you know, medicine and the experience of medicine. Like, why make this public? Like, what was that decision about? Was it difficult to do? Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah. It started out as a blog that I did when I was going through cancer, partly because everybody kept asking me how I was doing and I got tired of talking about it all the time. So I decided I'm just going to start a blog and then people can just read it and find out how I'm doing and I can just update everybody at the same time. And it was also a way of bringing creativity and expression to an experience that felt so overwhelming and dark. And what I was writing about it helped me make sense of it. It helped me kind of craft a narrative.
Hmm.
And it helped me put language to emotions that were really overwhelming and difficult and scary. And so I feel like when you can name the emotion, when you can assign words to what's happening and how you feel about it, somehow it gives you power over the experience.
Hmm.
And so it helped me feel like I had a deeper and better understanding of what was happening and that somehow I owned the experience because I was the narrator of it.
Right.
And so that became an important part of the cancer journey, was writing about it for all of those reasons. And then it ended up going into the book. And then now I post about it on social media. So 2 weeks ago, I had to have a bone scan because I've broken both my ankles this year for like no great reason. Like stepping off a bus, you shouldn't crack your fibula, but I did somehow.
Right.
So anyway, I did go for a bone scan. So that was terrifying. and then I had to have an oncology follow-up. And I write about it now because I want people who are feeling the same emotions, who are going through things that are scary and dark and overwhelming and terrifying, to understand that they're not alone.
Yeah.
That's why I write about the cancer now.
Yeah. Which is to some degree, I mean, you're passing on your own experience. I mean, you putting your, it's where that like art and self-discovery and connectedness all comes together, because you were finding a place to kind of be connected to your own story in the blog and find yourself in it, and then realize that you could pass that same gift on to others if they were able to read it.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And I think it's Nouwen who says the most personal is the most universal.
Yeah.
And yeah. So the more specific we are about the suffering that we're experiencing, the more people can relate to it, because it's so raw and so deep and so authentic and honest that other people can find themselves in the story. Maybe for a completely different reason, but they feel the same emotion.
Yeah.
And when you describe how that emotion feels to you and how you're able to deal with it or cope with it or understand it, then other people can find themselves in that story yes. too. And maybe it offers them, if not a pathway, at least reassurance that they're not the only one in the world that feels that scared today.
Yeah. And do you find that, I mean, so kind of another layer to this, like, do you find that happening when you post things? Mostly you are at, you spend a lot of time at, on Instagram and some on Facebook. Do you find that empathetic connection? Do you find people resonating? This is kind of a both hand question. There's like, there's a you and your own tribe conversation here, but there's also kind of like function of the internet. As a woman online sharing about your personhood, your body, your health, do you find that there's an the kind of empathy, the kind of reaction, the response and leading you want? And if and when you don't, what are the obstacles there?
Personally, I find a lot of empathy when I write about these things, and I also find a lot of people responding to it, either in the comments or even just sending me private messages saying, thank you for talking about this. I was crazy. I thought I was the only one.
Yeah.
And so from my experience, it's been a pretty healthy, positive experience. The part that trips me up in my personal life is when I try to date guys. My dating life is much more problematic than the social media sharing of the cancer.
Like, you mean like as a separate thing, or as like because of who you are online and you've told your story publicly, it complicates your dating life?
No, I'm just talking about sharing the realities of my life, because I've had cancer and yes. I've had a mastectomy. I've chemo put me into premature menopause, so you know the possibility of having children's off the table.
Yeah.
And the difficult, painful experiences that I've had from sharing my cancer experience, it has not happened online in general. You know, like the general public and the people that follow me on social media are really kind and caring. And at the same time, the things that have happened to my body don't specifically affect their future in the way that like a potential romantic partner.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
You can't have kids, or you've had reconstruction on your chest, or all of those things. So that's the part I've had to grapple with and navigate the most.
Yeah. Some of, in my experience of you, I mean, some of your, I don't want to call it a confidence, freedom, the sort of like, I mean, it's an authority, I guess. The authority with which you communicate physical health and talk about, you know, bodily health it kind of, there's this framework that you've experienced, you like a larger cultural framework that you don't just come across. You've actually sought out more regularly as time has gone on in relationship to like a world of people who don't have access to medicine the way you and I do. There's an early story that we can maybe get to depending on how the conversation goes, but your more recent book called Well, it actually starts off with this scene of you're not in the United States and you lose a patient. Can you recount this a little bit? And I want to get to this, like the line here that it resonates with me really deeply, someone who's like, I've lost a lot of people in a lot of different ways. The line here in the scene is, you said, you know, if I can't prevent his death, the least I can do is witness it. That you've borne witness to sickness and death. There was an initial kind of introduction that kind of broke into your life a little bit, but then you've continued to seek these stories and realities out and be part of them. Can you first like talk about this scene a little bit? You where were you? What was going on? How did you lose that patient?
In 2015, I started pursuing the idea of practicing medicine internationally in developing or under-resourced countries. And the first trip that I took was to Togo, which is a little country in West Africa that the United Nations in 2013 ranked the least happy country in the world out of 170 countries, because the suffering that's happening there is so great. And I went there to practice medicine at a hospital for 3 months. And one of the first days at the hospital, I was rounding on patients. So the staff that's worked overnight rounds with the staff that's coming on to shift, to give you a little bit of an update in the story about each patient that you're going to be taking care of. So I was coming on, the night team was going off. We were rounding on a patient who was unconscious, kind of half propped up in bed and had a bandage wrapped around his head, like a Revolutionary War soldier. And they said that he'd come in with altered mental status and a fever, and they'd quickly figured out he had AIDS, which nobody had known before. And the AIDS had caused a fungal infection to happen in his brain. Hmm. And it was putting so much pressure on his brain that he was at risk for herniating. So having his brain stem come through the little hole in the skull, which kills you.
Yeah.
So they took him to the OR and they drilled holes in his skull to release the pressure. And they said that as soon as they did that, there was so much infection. They said it looked like there was cottage cheese spilling out of his skull.
Man.
All from this fungal infection. So they took as much pressure off his brain as they could. They put him on all of the antifungal medicines that we had, but he hadn't woken up from surgery and his vital signs were growing worse and worse. Wow. To the extent of just wild vacillations. His heart rate would speed up and then drop down and even come close to stopping. His blood pressure was up and down. I mean, he was just on the brink of death and there was nothing more we could do. And I knew that we were going to lose him and I couldn't do anything to bring him back. I couldn't change the fact that we're in Togo where half the time there's no electricity at the hospital. We don't have the medicines. We don't have the resources. We don't have the specialists that we would have in the U.S. There's nothing I could do about that, but I could witness this man's death so that his two brothers who were there with him knew that there was somebody at the hospital who really cared that their brother was dying, so that they wouldn't have to be alone in witnessing the death, and so that this man's death wouldn't dissolve into a statistic about the number of people that die in the developing world every year because they don't have access to quality medical care. And so I did. I stood there and I watched him die. And at the end, after he was gone, you know, the monitor was beeping like crazy because obviously in the U.S., you'd call a code blue if somebody's vital signs are doing that. Yeah. So the monitor's doing like crazy, but he's gone. So I reached up and turned off the monitor, and I just thought about Jesus's words on the cross as he's dying, which is tetelestai, which means it is finished.
The way you write it, you said, I had other patients to see, medications to order, and lab results to review, and yet I continue to stand at his bedside. That the thing you do, and actually you come, the line you come to that has become a kind of mantra for you and for readers of yours is this notion, this, I get to more of a practice, love looks around. That like you actually to actually give attention. There's a way to in medicine and in a relationship, in really any facet of human life, there's a way that actually offering one's attention can be as important, especially in a moment like that, where there isn't a particular care you can give, there isn't a fix you can offer, there isn't like a thing per se to do, but you can offer and give your attention to actually pay attention, to look around, to be present, that was the gift you could offer. And you and I both know that in the medical world, in the religious world, the legal world, the political world, in the world of neighbors, it's the thing we don't do. It's like when the fix goes away, when, you know, when all possible, you know, roads recourse and, you know, the doables go away, we tend to not offer the last thing we have on the list, which is our attention, which ultimately is the thing that makes any of the rest of it worth it. It's a matter of attention. That for the doctor, for the medical staff to stay in the room with his brothers and say, I'm here with you, was like, that was the thing to do.
Right. And my theory is that's why people say so many stupid things to people who are suffering, is because they do feel this obligation to fix it, to say something helpful, to fix the situation, to tell somebody how to navigate it so that it's not quite so hard.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's helpful, but I understand why people do it.
Yeah.
I understand if you give up this idea that you can fix it, that you can help improve the reality of what somebody's facing, that you feel powerless and you feel really awful about that. But I think, you know, I often think about Job's friends. They get really bad, right? Job's friends went down in history as the least helpful friends in the world, because when Job, they visit him on the trash heap and they try to explain and rationalize and figure it out and tell him what to do about it and why it's happening. And everything that they say is so hurtful and wrong and misguided. But I think what people miss is that Job's friends would have gone down as the best friends in the world if they had just shown up and shut up.
Yeah.
Because they were the only people to climb through the trash to get to their friend.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they really cared about Job. They came closer to him and were more present to him than his own wife. The only reason why they screwed up was because they tried to explain it and they didn't understand that witnessing their friend suffering and being present to him in that suffering was enough.
Recently, that was 2015. You actually just got back a few weeks ago from South Sudan.
I did.
You were there for a couple weeks, 2 weeks. You were there for a while.
3 months.
You were there for 3 months. Talk about talk about the decision to go. Who you were there with? What were you doing? What was that? That sort of, again, that sort of continued pursuit of like, here's a place where the experience of medicine, experience of life in a body is dramatically different than the experience of life in a body is in San Francisco where you live.
Yeah.
Tell me about going. Tell me about why you went. Tell me about the trip.
Yeah. So last year I went to South Sudan for a month, and this time I went back for 3 months because I was so compelled by the people there and by the level of suffering. South Sudan is an active war zone still, even though it split from Sudan in 2011 to try to end the civil war. Mm-hmm. And it's a very difficult, dangerous place still. To the extent that if you go on the State Department website for the U.S. and you look up different countries, they have different travel advisories. The South Sudan page says, we're not forbidding Americans to go there, but we will tell you that if you go to South Sudan, you are on your own. If you get into trouble, nobody from the U.S. is coming to get you. So wow. I went anyway. And I think maybe this is something that comes from having cancer and having grappled with my own mortality at 27, which is much earlier than many people do,
yeah.
is that I've already made peace with the fact that I am mortal and I will die. And I'd rather die doing something that makes the world a better place than not. And so I took a calculated risk and went to South Sudan. What happened was, when South Sudan became its own country, they set up their own public schools. There are only 5 colleges in the whole country, and many people can't afford to go to them, or it's too dangerous to travel to them. And yeah. so when they were looking for teachers, basically they just picked the oldest kids in the refugee camp and made them teachers. So I work with a nonprofit that's called Rebuild South Sudan that was started by one of the Lost Boys. And their main focus has been to do teacher training to bring these teachers up to speed, both in terms of academics, but also in terms of leadership, development, communication, that kind of thing. So they've been holding workshops for these teachers for several years now. And then before I even knew about Rebuild South Sudan, I actually got asked to go to a rural island off the coast of Western Kenya that's in Lake Victoria called Rusinga Island to teach first aid to teachers who teach at a school for kids who have been orphaned because their parents died of AIDS. Because the school is on an island, and if a child gets sick, they have to put the child on a moto, like on a moped taxi, get them to the ferry dock, wow. take the ferry an hour to the mainland. Once they get to the mainland, it's a 3-hour bus ride to Kisumu, which is where the closest mm-hmm. major hospital is. And so if a child gets sick, it's a big, big problem, and the teachers don't have any idea what to do. So I went and taught basic first aid and pediatric medicine to these teachers and set up a clinic at the school so that they could care for these kids. So when Rebuild South Sudan heard what I had done, they asked if I would be interested in coming to South Sudan to do the same thing, because the weather pattern is 6 months of dry season, 6 months of rainy season. And in the rainy season, all of these roads, which are dirt roads, get washed out and they're right. impassable, which means the same thing happens where the child in that village or that right. community is sick. They can't get them out and nobody can get in. And so we figured out that the most qualified person to intervene in a situation when a child is ill or injured is often their teacher. They're the most educated person, and they're the person that knows that child and a person that speaks English so they can understand the medical training.
And they've got access to yes, that child and their
yeah,
family.
Exactly. They're there. Like, the teachers actually live at the school. Yeah. So I went last year and did a 3-day workshop for teachers to train them on how to, you know, splint a fracture, how to keep a child's spine straight if they fall, how to take care of wounds, how to dose malaria medicine, all of that. And then I spent a few days volunteering at the hospital in the community before I flew home. And I was just so moved by the amount of suffering and the lack of resources at the hospital.
Yeah.
They had run out of every single medicine that there is. They didn't even have Tylenol to give people Dang. Who were in pain or had a fever. They had run out of anesthetics. So they went to, you know, women who were in distress in labor or whose baby was in distress. And they said, we can do a C-section, but we don't have any anesthetics. So you'll feel it. You'll feel all of it. Or you and your baby can die. And the women said, we'd rather die. And they did, and they do. So this time I went back and I did some training, but mostly I went to the hospital and I ran the emergency room and the medical ward. And I trained the staff there about how to take care of things. And I also did a big GoFundMe campaign to help stock the hospital while they're figuring out the political situation and how to make the roads safe so that the convoys can get through.
When we talk about love looks around, you've been to Togo. You and I both have a relationship with Compassion International. Compassion works in Togo. There are so few organizations that work in Sudan. And that's for a number of reasons. There are also so few eyes that land on Sudan. So once in a while, I mean, was it just a few days ago, this newly formed Janjaweed organization, whatever they're called, RLF or whatever they call themselves now, murdered like 118 protesters.
Yeah, they found their bodies in the Nile River.
Yeah. Well, I mean, these are stories. I mean, that's page 12. Of some, you know, I mean, like, these are not stories that are circulating regularly. They're not popping up. It's not, you know, and I'm not looking to like diagnose and like put people down and like shame anyone in any shape or form. We only have so much, we talk about attention, we only have so much attention we can pay. Why is it, in your estimation, because you've been in Sudan, so not necessarily Sudan specific, why do we pay some attention, certain attention, to some regions, to some kinds of crises, and not to others? Like, what is it that draws wealthy American attention to one place versus another? Is there a thing that, like, you can kind of count on, this is why it happens this way? Is there a pattern? Like, what's your experience? What's your take there? Because it's not like, I mean, the crisis with regards to poverty, violence, sickness, like, there might not be a more difficult place and a more, you know, busted up place than Sudan, than South Sudan. It's awful. But we're not focused over there. Why not there? You know, see what I'm saying? Like if it's not about how bad it is, what is it that actually draws our attention?
Yeah. I think there are so many reasons why that could be. I think maybe as Americans, in terms of past experience, there's been this tendency to intervene in countries that have something to offer us. So famously, countries that have a large oil supply, we invade, intervene, support, etc. So I think, you know, we don't get any of our resources from South Sudan, and they're not a big ally. They're not kind of helping us out in the region. So I think sometimes the reason why Americans don't seem to care about regions is because we don't stand anything to gain from them, which is a very self-serving reason. But I think also, in terms of national media coverage, I think some things don't rise to our attention because they don't make the news, because there are so many competing stories and so many stories that have angles that are more sensational, that appeal to more people. So those are the one that make the stories that make the news. And then I think too, once we do know about a country and it has been brought to our attention and we do know about the suffering there, I think we can feel powerless to think, I'm just one person. This is a country of millions of people who are suffering. What could it possibly matter if I do something or anything? That's not even a drop in the bucket. And so I think that there is this tendency to become overwhelmed and to feel helpless and to feel like it wouldn't even make a difference if I tried. And so instead of trying to do something, we don't do anything. But what I think that we misunderstand what it means to make a difference in the world. I think we have become conditioned to think that the world is waiting for a couple billionaires to show up and fix the planet. The world is waiting for, you know, the Clinton Foundation or the Gates Foundation that have so much money in their pockets to show up and fix countries that are really suffering. But I don't think that one billionaire is as effective as a billion people that have $1 each that are doing what they can do as an individual. I think, you know, talk about making the world well. I don't think one person shows up on the scene and makes the world well. I think the almost 8 billion of us that are here give a little bit every day. And that's how the world becomes well. That's how everybody gets taken care of. And when we start to see that we are one person as part of the bigger solution and that our contribution does matter, that everybody's contribution matters, I think that's what can motivate us and can sustain us when we are trying to do good in really troubled, problematic places.
Let me wrap it up with this. Enjoyed your book. Passed it on to a few people. What does it look like for you in regular daily practice to be well? Like, what do you do? What does health look like for you? How do you practice health? How do you practice wellness? Like, are there metrics for you? How are you well? What are you doing?
Well, I love the word well more than health, which is why I called the book Well.
Got it.
Because you can technically be healthy, right? Like, you can go to the doctor and have every scan and test done, and there's nothing technically wrong with you. But if you are not happy, and if you're not practicing gratitude and kindness and compassion and experiencing joy in the world, you're not well. But on the other hand, there can be things wrong with your body. Your body can be failing. You can be suffering. You can be in a difficult experience. But if you are able to find joy, if you are able to find connection and practice kindness and compassion, you can be well in spite of whatever is technically going wrong with your body. And so for me, the idea of being well is not just how do I keep my cancer from coming back? How do I prevent heart disease and diabetes? That is part of it. So, I mean, in practice, what I do, I go to the gym at least 4 times a week. I do cardio and weights. I eat about 90% of my diet, I would say, is vegan. So it's very much plant-based. And I get plenty of sunshine. I spend time with friends. I visit my family or Skype with them as much as possible to just enjoy relationships. So those are all part of what I do. And then also I just try to notice and to see the ways in which I can practice gratitude. I can find joy. I can be kind to a stranger. I can see the world through this lens and see how connected we all are and see what contributions I can make today. And that for me makes for a life that feels really full and meaningful. And then I think too, the other reason why I called the book Well is because the opposite of a well is a cistern. And when I was in Togo, there is a pump on the main river that would take water from the river, take it to the water treatment plant where it was decontaminated, and then sent through all of these pumps where the water was fresh and new and clean every day. Well, one day that pump on the river broke and there was no water. And so people were so desperately thirsty that they started drinking water from cisterns that were, you know, years old. The water was years old. It had visible algae in it. And even in some cases, carcasses of rodents that had drowned in the water. People were drinking it anyway. They got horribly sick and started dying even faster. And what I realized is that, you know, when Jesus is talking about being the spring of living water, the other thing that I think helps me be well is to understand that thriving as a person in the world isn't about finding everything in my external environment to fill myself up with, whether it's, you know, a distraction, whether it's some kind of material goods, whether it's something that I enjoy that gives me pleasure. So it's not about filling me up with things around me, because those sources run dry and ultimately I run dry or get toxic, as in the case of the cisterns in Togo. Yeah. But when I tap in deeply to the love and the life of Jesus, that's the spring of living water, and that's the well. That's the clean source of water that never runs out and never goes dry and gives me life that lasts.
Amen. I love that. Hey, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. You're one of my favorite people. It was really fun to chat with you.
Well, good. I'll do my best to stay in good company there.
Okay, good. Thanks, Justin. It was so good to talk to you.
Absolutely. We'll do it again.
Okay, great. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the At Sea Podcast. If you'd like to follow up with Sarah the Barge and any of the work she's doing, her name is Sarah with an H, and the Barge is T-H-E-B-A-R-G-E. Most of our conversation revolved around her second book, which is called Well, Healing Our Beautiful Broken World from Hospital in West Africa. The book before that, which is kind of the emotional foundation of the work she does online, in writing, on Instagram, and in the second book, is called The Invisible Girls. It's a memoir, and it is beautiful. Check out both of those. You can actually jump to heartsandmindsbooks.com and pick up both of them from Byron, who's the best bookseller in America. If you'd like to follow up with me, I'm at justinmcroberts.com. And if you'd like to help support the work of this podcast, I'd love to have you on the team. Go to patreon.com and search my name, Justin McRoberts. Until next time.